Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
It is very weird to this day to meet people who have read that book and who remember that book and know more about me than some people who I dated for 2 years, because like all of the messy and most intimate stuff is there.
This week, my guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Frank Bruni. Frank is a longtime Times person. He has covered, among other beats, everything from the Vatican to George W. Bush's presidency. Serious Eaters, of course, know him from his long stint as the New York Times restaurant critic. He's the author of 4 books, including the poignant memoir, Born Round. Now he's the co-author, with fellow Times reporter Jennifer Steinauer, of A Meatloaf in Every Oven, 2 Chatty Cooks, 1 Iconic Dish, and dozens of recipes from Moms to Mario Batali's. Here to talk about restaurant criticism, and yes, the current administration, is the multi-talented Frank Bruni. Welcome to Special Sauce, Frank.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So we usually start by, and I know a little bit about this from reading your book and talking to you, but tell us about life at the Bruni family table growing up.
The Bruni family table. Well, it depended on whether you were talking, and the difference wasn't extreme, whether you're talking about my mom's table or my grandmother's table.
Okay.
My grandmother's table, that was the kind of more theatrical and operatic one. My grandmother may she rest in peace, was an immigrant from southern Italy. And I think the combination of being Italian and being from immigrant stock, you know, and having found a kind of better life in this country, it meant that food, and especially the plenitude of food, was an enormous thing. Like you not only showed, if you're Italian, you show love through food. And if you're someone who grew up with nothing, you show your good fortune and your new wealth. I mean, wealth being an exaggerated term
It's so interesting that you say that, because my grandmother was the same way, right? Grew up in abject poverty in Eastern Europe, and then came over here with nothing. And then when my father achieved a middle-class life and his sister did as well, she was so proud to serve canned fruit cocktail and what she called Havana Punch, which was Hawaiian Punch, because these were things that she, in her wildest dreams, she could never imagine have afforded.
Yes. It's funny how, I mean, that there's a real mentality that way. And as you were saying that, I was flashing back to my grandmother's side-by-side fridge. I remember exactly the kind of fridge she had. And this was a woman who could, from memory, without looking at a recipe, make extraordinary Southern Italian food. And yet nothing probably made her feel better and fancier than opening up the fridge and showing you where she had, or the freezer, I think, showing you her creme de menthe parfaits. Now, all that was creme de menthe artfully kind of dribbled or strewn throughout like vanilla ice cream. But to her, that looked so fancy. And I'm thinking, you know, even then, and especially now when I know a lot more about food, but even then I knew, Grandma, that is not your piece de resistance. You know, that is actually, you know, your lasagna, now that's worth talking about. You know, your manicotti, your orchiette made, you know, with your own thumb, one by one in your basement kitchen. Like, those are worthy of veneration. Your creme de menthe parfait.
Not so much.
Not so much. But in the same way you were talking about, that's how it was when you grew up with a certain kind of sense of deprivation. And you didn't have food that was purely frilly and ornamental like that. Food was very, very utilitarian, you know?
Yeah, it's true. But so you said there was a real difference between your grandmother's table and your mom's table.
Yeah, my mom absolutely absorbed my grandmother's ethos of, you know, more is better and large portions. And my mother was an extraordinary and an enthusiastic cook. She loved cooking. But it wasn't quite the overwhelming, like, you know, it wasn't quite the I'm going to put so much on the table, you know, that people are going to kind of fall to their knees and just surrender.
Right.
Because my mother had grown up, you know, as an upper middle class person in the suburbs of New York. Her dad was in advertising. And in fact, her family was a very, very waspy family, in which she remembered when she would get home from school or before dinner, she and her brother were supposed to leave her parents alone so they could have their evening cocktail. And the portions were restrained and the napkin was properly in the lap. My mother responded with a sense of kind of exultant liberation when she was acculturated into my dad's Italian family, because she much preferred bountiful, freewheeling. And so she ended up, one of the neatest things to watch as a kid was to watch my grandmother as she taught the next generation the dishes she knew. She stopped making them because as soon as my mother's lasagna rivaled and surpassed her own, she's like, okay, I'm passing the lasagna mantle to Leslie.
That's awesome.
The same thing happened with certain aunts of mine.
Yeah. So really, you came from a mixed marriage. You know, we always say that my wife's a German Jew and I, a Russian Jew, are a mixed marriage.
Yeah.
You were a mixed marriage, too,
My parents, interestingly, I mean, demographically, culturally, my parents were a kind of pairing that was so incredibly common in the 50s, which was Irish woman, Irish-American. My mother was a mix of Irish, Scottish, whatever, Italian man. And in that era, if you were as pale and freckled, you know, an upper middle class as my mother, marrying the Italian guy from the lower income family, that was a little bit of a provocative thing back then. It's crazy to think of that now. But that particular kind of dark light, that mix of genes, I'm astonished by the number of people I meet who have my exact same combo, Italian dad and then some version of WASP mom.
Did you ever think growing up that you would become a restaurant critic? Was that anything that was in your mind's eye or purview?
Oh, God, no. I loved food and I ate food. I ate too much food, as you know from my memoir, which we've talked about before. But I early on realized I liked to write. And so I might have had some notion that if I were lucky, I'd be able to make a career writing. And writing is what brought me into restaurant criticism. And I was a food lover, but I was a journalist. And I was kind of, you know, going along in a journalism career that was all about taking sudden turns and doing a variety of things. So, I mean, I came into the restaurant criticism and the food writing from the writing in general, whereas
sure.
a lot of people, it's the opposite way. They're food lovers, they're restaurant lovers, and then they express that through writing, and writing is the second thing. For me, it was in the opposite direction.
What made the light go on? It's like, oh, I want to write. Like, did you read the paper? Was it a novel that you read?
You know, I wasn't actually much of a newspaper reader in middle school, high school. I mean, probably, badly so. I wouldn't have been the keenest person in any of my classes when it came to current events. I loved reading, though. And I remember my mother belonged to several of those. One of them, I think, was literally called the Book of the Month Club.
Sure.
And I remember the enormous wall of books in the living room, you know, where I grew up, several living rooms because we moved. And I remember kind of constantly walking up to that wall. I knew when the new books had come in. And I probably read two or three adult style novels. When I was a kid. In fact, my mother should have watched the thing better because I remember, like, at the age of 12 and 13, because of some of what came into that bookshelf, we're not talking high literature in all cases, I remember reading Sidney Sheldon's The Other Side of Midnight at the age of 12.
Very racy.
And being completely baffled by some of the sex scenes, having no idea. I remember reading Scruples by Judith Krantz. So we're not talking, like, you know, Dickens and Tolstoy. I mean, those came along in time and in school, but I just loved to read. And I think for a lot of people who love to read, you find that you have a fluency with writing because you've got that rhythm and those voices in your head. And if you write with any kind of success or any nice reception, it's an encouragement to keep on writing. And I'm just the kind of person, you know, if I'm traveling, I have a notebook open, you know, and I'm kind of like recording phrases or sentences because it's just the way I process the world. It's the way I've always processed the world. So I'm just really, really lucky that I'm actually getting paid to do that.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because I never grew up thinking I would be a journalist or a writer. And I was a fanatical newspaper reader. In my family, we had three newspapers delivered every day. Newsday, the Herald Tribune, and the New York Times. Mm. And I was reading them cover to cover. So when I started writing freelance stories for the Times, it's like, I know how to do this,
yeah.
you know, because, oh, yeah, you connect sentences with quotes.
Right, right.
You know, and then...
Yeah.
And
we didn't have... In my home, we lived first in Westchester County, and we got something called the Reporter's Dispatch, which I don't know if it's still called that. It was the Gannett newspaper. It became the Gannett newspaper. And then during the high school years, I lived in the suburbs of Hartford, and we did get the Hartford Courant at home. We did not get the New York... Actually, we got the New York Times on Sunday. And as a teenager, my kind of first obsession as a reader and writer was cultural stuff. And I do remember very well knowing when the Sunday paper got there and commandeering the arts and leisure section. And that was probably the only section in the Sunday Times when I was a teenager that I read. But I mean, I remember Vincent Canby was doing the movie reviews. To me, there was no person in the world more famous than Vincent Canby because his name was all over that arts and leisure section of the New York Times.
That's fascinating. So when you were covering the Vatican, you grew up Catholic, right? Or
really loosely. I mean, I'm raised Catholic. I was baptized and I had communion, but it was a very lax Catholic upbringing.
When you got the Vatican beat, was that a dream job? Did that just happen? Did you seek it out? I mean, I know at the times there were, the Lord works in mysterious ways. I get that.
But I didn't exactly seek it out. So the Vatican job is part of and a byproduct of the Rome job. So whoever is our Rome bureau chief, which is what I was from 2002 to 2004, whoever's the Rome bureau chief covers the Vatican. That's about, depending on who the Pope is, what's going on, that can be anywhere from a fifth to a third to, at moments, a half of your beat. So that's how I ended up covering the Vatican. I think one of the many reasons they chose me for the Rome job was that I had done through time, in an erratic but sustained way, reporting on religion and on the Catholic Church. When I had worked at the Detroit Free Press, my paper before the New York Times, I had done a number of big religion stories. I had written a book about child sexual abuse by Catholic priests that had taught me quite a lot about the inner workings of the Catholic Church. So one of the arrows in my quiver, when they were evaluating people for the opening they had in the Rome Bureau, when I ended up being chosen to go there, one of the arrows in my quiver was, this is not somebody who's starting at zero when it comes to knowledge of how the Catholic Church works. Vatican coverage was the least favorite part of my job. I loved covering Italy, fascinating country. I mean, that was the lure. It's my background. I loved bopping around Europe, which is what you do if you're in any of those, if you're stationed in any of those capitals. And I even was fascinated by the fact I would frequently parachute into Israel or Turkey when something was going on there. Because of those 2 years as the Rome bureau chief, I got to see all those places that most of us only read about, but read about constantly in our lives. Like, you know, I've been on the Gaza Strip. I've been in the West Bank. I've seen Nablus, Hebron. It's fascinating if during your life you've constantly read those datelines to finally have like a topographical visual on what you've been reading
Absolutely.
About. The Vatican I didn't enjoy covering because it makes the White House look like an open society. It's extremely closed. It's not a beat you can cover with a lot of sourcing. There aren't that many people who will have real conversations with you. And an enormous amount of it is, when I was there, was following Pope John Paul II around waiting. I don't mean this to sound irreverent, but waiting for him to die. He was extremely ill. He was having trouble getting through masses. And there were a number of news organizations, including The Time, that wanted to make sure they had eyes there should he ever meet his end in public. I don't mean that ghoulishly, but that's the way the news business works. And so when he would travel and I would go on those trips to cover him, he wasn't sometimes even doing something newsworthy enough for me. So I would go to Slovakia for 3 days and follow him around.
Just in case.
Just in case. So that was not at all a dream to cover the Vatican then.
Do you know that one of my brothers, I'm one of four, became the Pope's maestro because he was the conductor of the Krakow Symphony. And
what's your brother's name? I think
Gilbert.
Yeah, I've interviewed him. He was one of the people when I was the Vatican reporter. I forgot you guys were related. Yeah, he would occasionally. He was one of those people in the absence of people who were super duper close to the Pope who would talk to you because he'd had interchanges through the musical world. He was someone we would quote occasionally. And he was a legitimate quote. But I mean, that's how kind of creative and far afield you have to go and be when you're doing Vatican reporting.
Yeah, because that's interesting. I never really thought of it. But of course, it would be true. That's like trying to develop sources at the Vatican.
Yeah, I've met your brother. I keep forgetting that. Wow. It's hard to think of the two of you in the same very different career paths.
Yes,
you know?
Very different. Nobody breaks bread with the Pope, right? Did you even get to break bread with a cardinal?
Yeah, there was, sure. I mean, not frequently cardinals, but but a few, and there was a gentleman whose name I should not mention who was an American fairly high placed in the Vatican who liked me and who also was one of the Vatican officials, and this is not true of all of them, who truly did live in a humble way. You know, I mean, some of them live in more splendor than they would want the world to know and then is kind of consistent with what one thinks of as the truest Catholic principles. This gentleman lived very humbly. He lived in Vatican City. He was an aide to one of the most powerful cardinals. And we enjoyed each other's company, and he trusted me in the sense that he would talk fairly candidly with me, and saw over time that I knew how to use that in a way that didn't end up causing him grief, but ended up informing my reporting. And we would, if I was in Rome on a given weekend, which was a big if because the job involved a lot of travel, pretty much with rare exception, we would meet Saturdays for a noon lunch at the very same restaurant, not far from the Vatican. We both loved it very much. And he would bring the pack of Marlboros I was smoking at the time, and I would handle the rest. You know, bottle or two of wine, nice fish lunch, whatever.
Cacio Pepe.
Right. And so he was someone I broke bread with very, very, very frequently. And I'm sad to say I've lost touch with him because I enjoyed his company quite a lot. Very smart guy.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about becoming the Times restaurant critic. You know, you became arguably the most powerful restaurant critic in America without any experience, you know, either as a critic or a cook. And I've always wondered about this, and I've discussed it with other friends of mine at the Times. Did that ever come up? They would never give the Washington bureau chief job to someone who hadn't covered politics in a very significant way. At least
they might not give the Washington bureau chief job to someone who hadn't covered politics in a serious way, but they have certainly over time, many times, sent somebody out like to write about politics. I mean, not being the bureau chief, but to write about politics in a serious way, who comes from the culture desk, because they realize that's a different angle and a fresh set of eyes. They've taken kind of quote unquote style reporters and made them parts of the team or given them prominent roles in covering public figures, because they realize that is that's a fresh set of eyes. It's someone who's going to use a language that's not so much can't, you know, inside or can't. So in that sense, there's a precedent. But I think the better parallel or metaphor is the following one, which is nobody ever says when they appoint a movie critic, but that person's never made a movie.
I thought about this yesterday.
That person's never read a screenplay. Most architecture critics have never sketched a building or have nothing to do with, you know, you don't ask of an art critic where's their painting. So this notion that a restaurant critic should be an accomplished cook is really weird. No, what a restaurant critic should be, and this is what I think their thinking was, but to be honest with you, they didn't talk about this with me. I mean, they obviously talked about these things behind closed doors when they were mulling the plausibility of me. But I think with a restaurant critic, the concern is this somebody who has eaten out enough in his or her life that they have an appropriate yardstick, that they realize the difference between magnificent and run-of-the-mill, you know, that they have a context and enough points of reference that you're not just shoving them into an arena that they've never experienced. And so I think the question about restaurant critics is, have you been a lifelong restaurant consumer?
Yes.
Or even better yet, connoisseur, without being too, you know, kind of lofty about it. And in that case, I had worked at the Times for, I think it was 15 years at that point. Maybe it was a little less. I lose track of time. They knew that I was a committed eater. They knew that I was someone who had traveled a lot, who had spent a lot of time in restaurants. And I think that's what concerned them more than whether I could go into the kitchen and whip up a souffle.
I think that's right. And I thought about that movie critic metaphor, too, when I wrote the question. I was like, well, you know, because
our music critics have listened to, like our rock critics, they've listened to a lot of music over time. I bet you most of the most prominent rock critics out there have never played an electric guitar.
You know?
Some of them may not know how to write a piece of music. And that's the relevant, I think, analogy.
John Perellis, you know, gave me my first story I used to write about music when he was the music editor at Rolling Stone. And so I got to know John. We've lost touch. And I think he had a background in music, but I don't think he was a player by any means.
Right.
Robert Sietsema, by the way, now a critic at Eater, was in a band.
Yeah,
he then became a food critic and he'd become a music critic.
There you go. Yeah.
So you never know. So you wrote a memoir, which was beautifully written, Born Round, that detailed your very complicated relationship with food.
Yes.
Tell us about, I mean, was it a painful process? Was it a hard subject for you to write about?
No, in the sense that it is extremely kind of cathartic and constructive to write about a subject or an issue that has tortured you during your life. For starters, I don't think I would have or could have written it if I hadn't felt like I was on the far side of the worst of all of that. And so it was written from a place of gratitude and celebration, maybe is even the right word, that I'd survived a bunch of very tough times and in some ways healed and learned to manage my life and my appetites better. It almost felt like a privilege to be able to kind of process and reflect on and try to explain all of this to other people through writing. The tough part for me actually came after the book came out and exists to this day, which is you've read the book. It's really, really, really candid.
It's extremely candid.
Yeah, I felt, I mean, you know, I embarrass myself all over the place. And when I was doing it, I felt from an aesthetic point of view, intellectual, moral, I felt like if you are going to ask people to read your life story or a portion of your life story, if you're going to ask them to spend time with a memoir, you owe them, for starters, you owe them candor.
Yep.
You know, I mean, this can't be an act of brand management, although it is for so many politicians and that sort of thing. So I just decided the only way to write this was just to really just be incredibly truthful and generous with that sort of information. It is very weird to this day to meet people who have read that book and who remember that book and know more about me than some people who I dated for 2 years, because like all of the messy and most intimate stuff is there. And that's a very discomforting, self-conscious making thing.
Yeah.
That's the tough part.
I believe that. I mean, you confronted many demons with that book,
yeah.
You know, eating disorders, body image problems.
Right. And I'm not by nature an exhibitionist. You know, I'm not as journalists. As like commentary journalists go, I do less TV than others. I mean, I'm more of an introvert than an extrovert. And so, you know, I've done a lot of public speaking over the last couple of years about college admissions because I wrote a book about that. And in a way that's extremely flattering because it meant people come up to me at the end and say, I loved Born Round. That meant a lot to me. And there's a moment right there where I can feel myself blushing because
wow.
I'm like, this person has essentially seen me without clothes on. This person has essentially been in bed with me. You know, this person has been with me when I was bent over a toilet throwing up a meal, not to be gross. I mean, and that, by the way, that, as you know, that didn't happen when I was restaurant critic,
right.
Going many years back. But it's really weird to think this human being who's been watching me speak for the last hour and is now standing in front of me knows exponentially more about me than I could possibly know about him or her. And it's a very, very unsettling feeling.
But just because it's personal doesn't mean, like, you didn't decide to settle any scores.
Oh, no. I mean, in fact, I the only person I think who ends up embarrassed in my book is me, which is, I think, as it should be. I after it came out, I mean, I remember I must have read it 100 times, not because it was flattering, but there was a review in the Times Book Review. And as always, they assigned the review to someone who'd never met me and didn't know me, and weren't putting their thumb on the scale in any way. And that review was among the most lovely, complimentary. But in it, there's a line in the review, which I remember, that said the love with which Bruni writes about his family is breathtaking. And even as I say that now, I almost want to cry because I am so blessed with my family, with my siblings, with the parents I had. My dad's still alive. I was not going to write one of those memoirs.
Yeah.
That was going to embarrass anybody in my family. Me, okay, I have a right to embarrass myself, but and I was very, very, very mindful of that line.
Yeah.
You know, between sharing my family with people and exploiting them.
Yeah.
And nobody came to me after the book with any problems or complaints. There's one scene in the book in which my brother Harry doesn't look so good.
Right.
And I actually shared it with him beforehand in manuscript, and I said, I want to show you this. It's important for me to put it in the book for the following reason, but you say no and it's gone. And
wow.
He said, yes, fine, keep it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. There's a lot I can learn from that. That's really interesting. So one of the things I know about you when you were a critic is that your fridge was always empty. It had leftovers.
Yeah.
Is your fridge fuller now than it used to be? Like, what's in it these days?
Oh, it's absolutely fuller. I mean, it's full mostly with common sense everyday food. I live with a partner. We've been together 8 years. We probably eat out 3 nights a week, you know, both together and separately, and maybe eat at home 4 nights. And when we're eating at home, we tend for the most part, to use those nights to eat more sensibly so that when we're out, we're not watched. So if you opened my fridge, you would see many different kinds of greens. You'd see some spinach leaves. You'd see arugula. You'd see a lot of that sort of produce. You'd see a lot of salad fixings. You'd see some feta cheese. You'd see some Parmesan cheese. You'd see olives. You'd see, I mean, all, you know, you'd see some chicken breasts.
Capers.
Sort of thing. You'd see, I love roasting Brussels sprouts. You'd see a lot of Brussels sprouts. You'd see a lot of wine because we like our wine. That sort of thing. But it's pretty full. You know, you'd see breakfast-wise, you'd see yogurt and you'd see blueberries, you know, and then on the counter you'd see a tin of almonds and walnuts and that sort of thing. And then for the last couple of years, you would have often seen the makings of meatloaf because of the meatloaf cookbook. So most of what happened in that fridge and in my kitchen was healthy stuff because we're being unhealthy or being less healthy when we're eating out, or meatloaf stuff. So if you open the fridge at a given moment, you might have found ground chicken, ground turkey, ground lamb, ground beef. You might have found all those different, but all in ground form because they were there to be used in the development of meatloaf recipes.
Let me stop our guest right there. And next week, we'll resume our conversation with New York Times op-ed columnist, fighter for political sanity and equal rights, and, of course, meatloaf advocate, Frank Bruni. I'm Ed Levine. Thanks for listening, Sirius Eaters. More to come.